are away on holiday that you know is going to remind you not to swim too far from the beach. When I did open it several days later, I scanned it quickly to see if there was any cataclysmic news, but registered only the usual keywords. God, several times, love, unselfish, Father Abbott, community, blessings, wonderful, dear, many times, dear everywhere, in fact. Father Joe's usual tone, letter writing of an earlier age, chatty but formal, following a set formula of greeting, apology, news, counsel. Normally, I would be waiting for that point in every letter where the formality cracked a bit, and I would hear his stuttering, question-ending sentences. Nothing like the full-strength Father Joe, but unmistakably his voice, which had always made me want to jump on a plane. Now, in the initial flush of my lampoon passion, learning its ropes and applying its lessons, all that crossed my mind was, I bet I could write a great parody of a Father Joe letter. I almost sat down and did it. I didn't, of course. What would be the point when only I and 60-odd monastic non-subscribers 3,000 miles away would get it? But that wasn't quite why. I'd already learned, and repeated to the New York Times, the routine lampoon defense of even its cruelest parodies. You only parody the things you love. We rarely went as far as admitting the next step, and the truth, that you only parody what you once loved and now loathe. I certainly didn't loathe Father Joe and never would, but I knew I'd passed a milestone. I have him down, I thought. I can do him. Parody is also a way of owning and containing what once you were in awe of. For me, the lampoon, and I was not alone in this, was a kind of delayed adolescence. Partly the normal adolescence I never had, partly the metaphorical adolescence all immigrants go through, in which the basics of work and sex and community are learned, and the social reflexes and instincts that swim just below the surface of the collective consciousness are absorbed. I was doing this backward, having become a parent first, but now finally I was flexing my muscles, spreading my wings, shouldering aside the only father I'd ever acknowledged. Small wonder blasphemy made me giddy. It was a very specific truancy, a very private rebellion. That whisper of misgiving, that shadow of fear, was neither guilt nor fear of hell. They were natural reactions to letting go, loosing the ropes, jumping off the cliff, the momentary hesitation before you embrace independence. Blasphemy was the symbol of the larger hopes I had for the lampoon, and of an attitude toward other institutions than religion, in fulfillment, long delayed, of the epiphany I'd had a decade earlier in the Arts Theatre. For the first time since I'd met him, 16 years before, I felt I didn't need Father Joe to navigate the waters ahead. There were other, more experienced sailors from whom to learn. Not just how to survive, but how to be the terror of the high seas, how to sail like the pirates of New Providence in their nimble sloops, up under the stern of some vast galleon of corrupt and bloated empire, and sink the bastards at the waterline with a single shot. Chapter 13. Pirates like Michael O'Donoghue. O'Donoghue was extraordinary. The plutonium rod at the core of the lampoon. As remarkable and devastating a personality as Father Joe was pacific and self-effacing. But they had a few things in common. Stringy chestnut ringlets surrounded a fierce white face with blood-red lips, death cell of countless Virginia Slims. He wrote with incredible precision, each perfect word set in its perfect place, like a razor blade concealed in a mouth-watering amuse-gueule. He had a unique gift for drawing humor from things that normally made people recoil. He was the funniest of the group. Laughter followed him everywhere. But Yux didn't do it for O'Donoghue. Making people laugh, he said, is the lowest form of humor. Within weeks of my arriving at the Lampoon, to my utter surprise, we hit it off. We began collecting material for the Lampoon's first comedy album, to be called Radio Dinner. For economic and ecological reasons, Judy and the girls were now ensconced in an ancient stone house near the Delaware Valley, which I'd bought several years earlier when my paycheck and I were considerably fatter. It was a bus ride of several hours. As a New York base, O.D. offered me his couch in his vast, drafty Soho loft. It was packed with bits of late Victoriana that had odd or disturbing purposes. A gout stool, mannequin limbs, a silver grape peeler, deceased dolls, stuffed animals, things that might be shrunken heads or long-dead rodents, sinister daguerreotypes, and everywhere card files, each card containing a comic haiku of exquisite horribleness. He had a small-town background, Rochester, New York, and a similarly humdrum education. But he soaked up crucial phrases and ideas from countless sources. Kafka, matchbook covers, old copies of Life, the original Nosferatu, the Book of Common Prayer. Flotsam and jetsam of every subculture, violently juxtaposing them to produce a poetry of humor. He spoke in brittle, slashing phrases that gave new vigor to the cliché verbal fencing. He really did thrust and cut and lunge, and his word choices had the sharpness of fine steel. You parried at your peril. Attack was the only way to keep up with him. I soon realized that the incessant verbal contest was teaching me to think and talk and write in American. It was sharper, harder, quicker to the punch than the more oblique forms I'd grown up with. You're circumlocuting again, Hendra. I believe circumlocution means removing the foreskin from an otherwise healthy joke. What he saw in me, I wasn't sure. I was a rarity in his circle, the downtown Velvet Underground crowd, a man his age with kids. Kids and parents intrigued O'Donoghue mightily. It drove his strongest work, like the Vietnamese baby book, which he did for my first issue, a saccharine-sweet baby blue memento of baby's first year. Except the baby was one of those machine-gunned at My Lai. Or his SNL character, Mr. Mike, the ultimate loco in Loco Parentis. In the spring of 1972, we produced Radio Dinner, which contained, to our knowledge, the first parodies of folk and rock icons Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and John Lennon. Of these, Lennon was far and away the most sacred. When I first heard of O.D.'s intention to do a Lennon parody, which he called Magical Misery Tour, it actually gave me pause. Magical Misery Tour, a montage piece in the style of Yellow Submarine, had appeared in the magazine. Parodying Lennon on an album, his medium, was quite another matter. I had no qualms about Lennon's being too sacred, not after hanging out with O.D. for the better part of a year. But I wondered whether attacking the most loved and admired rock singer on the planet mightn't blow up in our faces. I thought this privately. Articulating it to O.D., I would risk being pinned to the woodwork like a bug. The Lennon parody was an object lesson in O.D.'s M.O. He had no interest in the fallout from it. The more furious the reaction, the better, even if people threatened to kill us. Someone actually did try to blow us up while we were recording the album by sending us a parcel of unstable dynamite. So this wasn't out of the question. The limitless love and respect people accorded Lennon were what attracted O.D. to his target. It wasn't malice that drove him, though many people thought it was, but rather a fascination with the absolute, with pushing things far, far beyond all normal, reasonable limits, into a void where sacredness, veneration, respect, decency, any kind of social norm would not register, had no measurement or meaning. He was a friend of that void. There was something mystical about his attraction to it. If he had any belief system at all, It was that there existed a mirror image of the sacred, an absolute not-sacredness, which he was always striving to attain, and to improve his ability to attain. He had total satirical contemptus mundi. He had no interest in Catholicism, which presumably was somewhere in his Celtic family tree, but this single-mindedness struck me as ferociously Catholic. I was reminded of those fierce Spanish saints that had terrified me as a teenager. Lennon was tough, himself no slouch in the satire department. A Day in the Life was one of the most unforgettable musical compositions I'd heard since The Rite of Spring. But he'd exposed his flank. In 1971, deep into primal scream therapy, he'd given a series of interviews to Rolling Stone, in which he ranted with primal frankness about his genius, his childhood, his hatred for his fellow Beatles and the Stones, his role in history, and much more good stuff. For Rolling Stone, these were the words made flesh. They ran the interviews verbatim. All OD had to do was take the choicest bits and arrange them into verses, and we had our lyrics. Music? Enter an old lampoon hand, Chris Cerf, who set them to a driving Imagine-style piano accompaniment. Perfect. Now all we needed was a singer. Our new young vocal genius, Christopher Guest, opted out. It was not his thing. There were those who could do it, but were nervous about professional retribution. We put off recording it again and again, desperate to find the right voice, until we finally ran out of studio time. Came the night when we either had to do it or dump it. OD had the vocal gifts of your average bivalve. So, it had to be me. Though I'd sung in the comedy act, I hadn't the slightest talent for impressions. But when I got into the booth, and Cerf went into his piano intro, something took me over. A voice I barely recognized, but which sounded a lot like Lennon's, began pouring out of me, screaming out his words in a ferocious tumble. It wasn't me. It was some superior or inferior being, an angel or a Dybbuk. It felt like being possessed. For the hour or so it took to record, I dwelt in OD's dimension of not sacredness, someone else entirely, someone without limits or boundaries, transfigured into a para-Lennon. It was glorious, hilarious, and as close to a mystical experience as anything I'd ever had at core. Radio Dinner was a success, and according to the powers that be, helped the magazine significantly in the areas of advertising and circulation. They wanted another album, and more of those rock parodies, please. In truth, neither OD nor I was very conversant with rock music or rock lyrics. Sean Kelly, however, was a master of the form. Live albums were all the rage at the time, so he and I put together an album called Lemmings, a full-scale parody of Woodstock and its icons, with a few non-Woodstock icons like Jagger thrown in. We cast Chevy Chase, John Belushi, and Christopher Guest in their first major stage roles in the show, which was to have a limited run at the Village Gate for purposes of recording. But even in previews, we were turning away hundreds of people. The Times and the New Yorker came to the opening night and gave us money reviews. We decided to extend the run beyond recording, and before we knew it, we had another hit album and an off-Broadway smash. But I was missing the magazine, that sleek, supple monster inside whose opaque folds and curves flashed constant arcs of brilliance, which, as Harold Ross once said of the New Yorker, went down in the elevator at 5 p.m. to split into smaller, buzzing, sizzling organisms, sliding into the night, across the city, continuing to probe and play and conceive and laugh at the dazzling connections to be made between wildly disparate terminals, the fun to be had at the expense of greed, corruption, hypocrisy, power, and stupidity. No genre of successful creative effort I'd been involved in to date, no sketch that brought the house down, no well-reviewed TV show, no record on the charts, no theatrical event that got standing ovations, ever gave me as much satisfaction as the heft in my hands of a new issue of the magazine, fresh from the printers. Product of that brilliant monster, it both represented the goal I'd embraced in the lobby of the Arts Theatre and fulfilled the need for community I'd felt all my life. It wasn't the community I'd envisaged, exactly. For one thing, it was on the banks of a river of yucks, but I was happy to dedicate the rest of my life to it. Visits to CORE settled down to a pattern which would continue throughout the decade, one every year or so. A trickle of letters continued, but more to me than from me. It was becoming very much a driven male in his 30s, aged parent relationship. Swamped as my brain was with projects, premises, concepts, and absorbing the information to feed them with rapidly evolving skills and habits of perception, not to mention having to survive the murderous politics of any successful magazine, I had entered the obligatory phase of my love for Father Joe. The only difference from a normal parent-offspring modus vivendi was that there was never a breath from him of, "You never come, you never write." He remained as serene as ever, as changeless. What had changed was that these qualities were no longer virtues in my world. Serenity to Manhattanites is likely to be interpreted as catatonia, changelessness as cluelessness, and both as indicative of a background in the boonies. A city whose true coat of arms is a wrecking ball rampant on a field of sheetrock has zero patience for the monastic virtues. This toxin had entered my bloodstream. Two visits in particular brought this home. On the first, I had made a flying detour to CORE in the process of tearing through London promoting the Lemmings album, half of whose targets were British. I had a pleasant enough chat with Father Joe, said hi to Dom Elred, ate lunch. As I hurried away down the driveway, late for the ferry, I was suffused with an unfamiliar emotion. Relief. It disturbed me enough that I fought it down, deeply ashamed. But the feeling was strong and real. For almost 20 years, after every visit I'd made to the Abbey, I would turn as the Portsmouth ferry headed out into the Solent, look back for that funny, round, elf-hat spire sticking out of the oaks, and say a silent goodbye. Often, in recent years, with a twinge of regret. This time, I felt nothing. My silent goodbye brought no twinge of anything, except that I suddenly found the spire dated and ludicrous. What on earth were the lines of Cordoba or Byzantium, whatever the hell it was, doing on the Isle of Wight? The era it came from, the decrepitude of Edward VII, was the most culturally bankrupt period in recent British history. Wherever had my affection for it come from? Ugly, man. One ugly church. As if depressed and diminished by my thoughts, the spire slid quickly behind the trees. The second time was worse. Father Joe's charisma, his funny, tick-ridden face and body language, were still there. But that was all that was left of CORE's charm. His world, bounded by pink and yellow brick walls, hemmed in by the greater walls of history that loomed around the place, depressed me no end. CORE seemed small, irrelevant, and insular. Its activities futile. Again I felt relief as the taxi sped toward the ferry, but this time I made no effort to resist it, happy to be returning to my exciting, stimulating, fulfilling modern life. When the ferry hit open water, I didn't even turn to seek out the lumpy spire. The ferry had a bar now, and I needed a drink. 1974 was our golden year. Monthly circulation hovered just under 1 million. O'Donoghue, inspired by Lemmings, began the National Lampoon Radio Hour, which also starred Guest, Chevy, and Belushi. When O.D. quit, Belushi took it over, bringing into the cast Gilda Radner, Bill Murray, and others, in effect with himself and Chevy, assembling the bulk of Saturday Night Live's first cast. There were a few trifling clouds in the sky. Nixon's resignation turned out to be a bit of a letdown. In the 1972 election, we'd run an item about a new PAC, Satirists for Nixon Agnew, with the slogan, "Keep them in office and us in business." Now we realized it hadn't been entirely a joke. We'd actually achieved our goal. We'd bitten the hand that fed us. Were things really going to get better? God forbid! A desire for change had always been implicit in the savagery of the Lampoon's M.O., though the editors would have died rather than admit so straightforward an emotion. Not change for its own sake, nor for missionary goals. We only wanted to save the world from people who wanted to save the world. The one thing we did believe was that we could accomplish this. Our cynicism was still in its first sweet innocence. Now a pair of criminals, one a convicted felon, had been removed from the White House. The military and its vile war had been properly defeated. The stranglehold of big money on the affairs of the nation appeared to have been loosened, and we appeared to have been part of it. Many years later, Carl Bernstein told me that not only was he a huge fan of the magazine, but that if it hadn't been for the National Lampoon, Nixon would never have resigned. He was only half joking. The savagery mellowed. There were many jokes about food that year. There was more unalloyed comedy, a lot of it about animals, notably the best-known cover we ever ran. A cute mongrel with a huge .44 Magnum in his ear, and the legend, "If you don't buy this magazine, we'll kill this dog." The group had mellowed, too. The magazine was approaching its fifth year, its circulation higher than that of most magazines that could be regarded as competitors, such as Esquire. We had our chops down. We were no longer brash new kids on the block. A subtle shift was evolving, both conceptually and editorially, toward restraint, a savoring of, a playing with absurdity, rather than ripping it to shreds. There was every expectation that we could become, were already, an institution, the humor magazine of America. These dreams were never fulfilled. In its fifth year, the magazine was convulsed by an internal buyout agreement, which led to the departure, several million dollars richer, of one of the founders. Kelly and I became co-editors and ran the magazine for the next 3 years. We had serious competition now from the show we had in several ways helped spawn, Saturday Night Live. In much the same way the English TV hit That Was the Week That Was had taken the wind out of Beyond the Fringe's satirical sails, SNL gave viewers a version of the Lampoon attitude, if not its content, each week for nothing. It was bound to hurt circulation. Eventually we held steady at about 750,000, still very respectable for a general interest magazine in a bear market. In 1978, the success of Animal House, at the time the biggest grossing comedy in Hollywood history, convulsed the magazine yet again. Though the editors saw the movie as a mainstream Lampoon satire of American higher education, the Nixonian Dean Wormer, the Young Republicans of Omega Theta Pi, its military, the ROTC, and Niedermeyer, the ROTC's psychotic student Patton, all brought low by the Delta's anarchic 60s insurgency, its satirical force was largely ignored by reviewers. The film was lumped with the mid-70s revision of the 50s and pre-assassination 60s as a better and more innocent era, a form of propaganda best expressed by Happy Days. In conventional cinematic wisdom, Animal House went down as the first gross movie. Eyeing the cool millions grossness was raking in each week, management demanded more of the same in the magazine. Kelly and I refused. Another editor, P.J. O'Rourke, was happy to oblige. He became editor-in-chief, the first person in the history of the magazine to arrogate the title to himself. In 2 short years, between 1979 and 1981, he turned a multimedia operation of phenomenal breadth and talent, capable of producing genuine comedy classics, into a monthly catalogue of masturbatory, automotive, and racist fantasies, defanging the magazine completely and presiding over a collapse in circulation from which it never recovered. Now, on this sad Santa Monica evening, the black saltwater fields beyond the deck stretching away to eternal night, well and truly into the dark decade Peggy Noonan would soon preposterously dub Morning in America, I realized what others had no doubt realized years before. The long moment of skepticism and sanity in America had come to an end. The Big Chill, they called it, a movie inspired by the death of Doug Kenny, one of the Lampoon's co-founders. Or was it Belushi's death? Or Lennon's? Death was everywhere. I ought to have known. Father Joe had drummed it into me long ago. The Lampoon, that raucous, riotous brotherhood, and its laughter, the demented force that bound us for one glorious nanosecond of truth, would pass, as all things must, like grass before the wind. I found some of the band's vodka. I gulped it to keep the elevator on my floor, to hold it from plunging down into the chasm which opened on so many nights now, but which I could ignore for a while with enough to drink or snort. My marriage was in ruins, if it had ever been constructed enough to fall into ruins. My beautiful, gifted wife, whom I knew from the start I hadn't loved, nor she me, except she was too polite to say so, was roaming the rubble, working at unfulfilling jobs, her promise and talent long shelved and forgotten. And it was all my doing. Once, when the kids were small, we'd gone to see a hypnotist somewhere in L.A., and she'd wound up on stage as a volunteer. The guy was a sadist, putting his subjects under, then telling them that they were animals or working at bizarre jobs. The crowd loved their antics, the more so because none of them remembered what they'd done when he brought them round. He hypnotized Judy and told her she was a ballet dancer. A previous woman subject had brought the house down with her dying swan. Judy went into an ethereal pas de deux with an imaginary partner, sweeping across the stage, her leaps and pirouettes so intense and elegant that the house was riveted. You could hear a pin drop in that theater, and there must have been 1,000 people in it. What magnetism she had! What stage presence she could have commanded if she'd ever had the time and freedom to train as the actress she'd wanted to be. The hypnotist was furious. He'd lost the crowd completely. He ran after her as she floated around the stage, the audience beginning to titter, but at him. Eventually he caught her and brought her out and tried to get a round of applause as if she were just another clown. The theater barely responded. The people around me were silent. They knew they'd seen something special and beautiful. Every guy who was anyone in Cambridge Theatre had wanted her, not just because she was beautiful, but because they all knew she had a big future. I wanted to love her. Who wouldn't, when having her with you made you look so great? But I didn't really, and she didn't really. It was one of those affairs that are approved and defined by others. When Cambridge ended, there was nothing left to keep us together. But by then it was too late. A sweet little girl was on the way, and then another, whom, for most of their childhoods, I largely ignored and certainly resented, because I had to be a father, which prevented me from fucking as many hippie chicks as everyone else appeared to be. "Be unselfish with her, Tony dear," his letters always said. Not, "Don't be selfish," but, "Be unselfish. I know you will be unselfish with her and your beautiful little girls." No father could have been more selfish, treating his family like props, possessions, inconveniences, mostly forgetting them completely in his precious mission to save the world through laughter. The air-headed heathens in whose company I passed my time had more morals. Sure, they exploited each other. Sure, they unwittingly caused pain. But most were blindly seeking good, boring their way like moles up through the dirt to the light, figuring out on their own that love and peace were the only worthwhile currencies in life. Whereas I, who had been given the keys to the kingdom, had held the pearl of great price, had dropped them in the mud, ground them in with my heel, and headed downtown to score. What had happened to that far-off boy, murmuring his ancient Latin words, humming his ancient music, full of hope, hankering for the infinite, all agog for sanctity? Yes, he was gullible and naive. Yes, what he thought were ecstasy and despair and faith and God were just neurons firing in his synapses, just proteins coursing through his brain. Yes, his beliefs were phallic fantasies, anthropomorphic projections, ancient archetypes implanted in his psyche over centuries, whatever the theory was this week. But he'd been a better, sweeter soul. He wasn't what I'd become. Not at all. He was someone else entirely, who died tragically young. Far away, across the Rockies, the Tramonto, across drowsy, sleeping states, across the jagged teeth of my hometown, across that other eternal night of an ocean, thousands upon thousands of miles away, was the man who had once been the center of my world, my calm harbor, my sheltering wing. A tiny lighthouse on a tiny island, blinking his faith into the night. Here comes the beam again, sweeping round, a pinprick in the darkness, sending out its simple, tiny message. Love. Love. Nothing but love. There. Now it's gone again. I had failed him. I had failed my vocation. I had failed my family. I had failed, period. I had nothing of worth. No hope, no faith, no God, no intellectual resources, no desire to use them if I had. It was all gone forever, as irretrievable as the wind. I fingered the bottle of Valium. I hated downers. They made me lose control of my body, and therefore of my heart. I had to stay alert, sometimes awake all night, to stop the only thing Dad bequeathed me, his lousy heart, from sneaking up and murdering me too. If I was going to die, I had to be in control. I'd never seen Valium before. The pills were rounded yellow triangles. Tiny trinities, the color of cowardice. I shook a dozen or so into my hand. How many would it take? I swigged a mouthful of vodka and tossed down two. I knew that wouldn't be enough, but I couldn't quite bring myself to do them all at once. Okay, two more. Hit the vodka. I stared out at the dark Pacific. Was I looking at Japan or New Zealand? Have to look it up tomorrow. What tomorrow? Not even drowsy. Fuck it, take another. Five now. That should do it. What if there was a hell? Was it too late to get a stomach pump? Did they bring it with them? How big was a stomach pump? Was I doing anything that merited hell? I'd confessed, sort of, at least to myself or to whatever. This was a pretty tough penance. Say three Hail Marys and kill yourself. What I was doing was fine and worthy. Saving the world from myself. Get it over with. I drained the vodka bottle, raised the half-dozen remaining pills in my hand slowly to my lips, composed myself for death, closed my eyes as if in prayer, and fell asleep. I woke 12 hours later. I ought to have had the hangover of all time, or at least a skull-cracking headache, but I had neither, as far as I could tell. Mind and body were utterly numb, like frostbite all over. I had no identity, no self I could detect. I wasn't relieved to be alive. I wasn't disappointed not to be dead. Just nothing. I knew only that I would try again someday soon. And next time, I wouldn't wake up. Not now that I'd had some practice. I got up and drove to the location. I was hours late for my call, but it was the first day of shooting and no one had noticed. I don't remember which scene it was. I think it was in the limo, or perhaps it was the coffee shop. The director explained the rules. They were terrifying. All I needed to know was the roadmap of the scene, a couple of sentences outlining what had to be accomplished during the 3 minutes or so it would run. It was up to me to improvise the lines. They could be whatever I liked, mundane or not, funny or not, just so long as they made the scene clear. I had no background in improv. In the 60s, I'd sat in on a session or two at Second City in Chicago, and its more radical offshoot, The Committee, in San Francisco, but always cheated, using lines from existing material. I'd been in awe while directing Belushi and Chevy and Chris Guest in Lemmings at how the words just flowed out of them and fit together, and weren't banal blather either, but hilarious stuff, as funny as anything you could write and rehearse. There were the other actors now, in their fright wigs, with, collectively, a couple of decades of improvisation under their belts. Intimidated does not begin to cover the way I felt. I was a complete and utter fraud. I couldn't do this. If I'd had any feelings at all inside me, instead of a quart of whatever vodka and Valia become after a night of interaction, I would have just balked right there and said, "I can't do this," and gone back to New York with my tail between my legs and a few dollars poorer, but with my pride intact. But who cared about pride anymore? Action. They were in character. They were brilliant. None of them was British, but they were doing flawless Brit accents. And funny. Understated, super real, hilarious. Normally I would have been helpless with laughter, but I had no intention of laughing ever again. One of them asked me something, and I heard a voice replying. It was sort of like mine, but with a touch of the nasal middle-class whine that was beginning to creep into everyday English. It was also a half-truth, not totally answering the question. I thought it was because I hadn't absorbed the roadmap, couldn't remember the answer I was supposed to give. But it wasn't that. Something was going on between us. Some kind of force was flowing between four equals, an instinctive understanding of the context. Something about the music we all shared, but had never quite voiced and was now coming out. It was all about rock and roll. Every cut of that cow no longer sacred, fat and flatulent, with udders as dry as beef jerky, but which, way back when, we had all in some way loved, even believed in. And the characters these guys had chosen to be needed this character that had come out of me. Not that I had chosen it, not the way they had theirs. It was more as if they had drawn it out of me. It was their character, not mine or me. And at that moment, I was very happy not to be me. Cut. I didn't want to cut. I didn't want it to be over. That would mean I had to be Tony again. With this other guy, there was a ray of hope. Happily, it wasn't over. Whatever we'd done was good, but could be better. We did it again, and then once more, and that was a print. I'd tried to prepare for this. One has to be professional. I'd dipped into the good book of improv, Viola Spolin's Improvisation for the Theatre, and read up on her son, Paul Sills, co-founder of Second City. I'd solicited Second City friends and veterans for help. I'd reconsidered the many times I'd been in improv theatres and witnessed that near-miraculous process when a cast is on, the two, three, or four actors shaping a common experience whose outcome is as yet unknown, discovering as they proceed the others on stage and each of their uniquely skewed worldviews. The scores or hundreds of audience members also guiding the experience by reacting, or not, to the choices made by the performers. A communal journey of discovery for everyone in the theatre, usually comedic, though not always. A couple of nights, Shay the Committee, at the height of Vietnam, had been anything but comedic, but were no less powerful and memorable for that. The whole, a completely unique experience which could only happen at one time, in one place, with one collection of individuals. The advice I'd gotten from every source, if I wanted to arrive at a similar apotheosis, was listen. Listen at every level, to the words, the emotions, the intent of the other or others. Be completely open to them. Bring nothing preconceived or prepared to the moment. Listen, and then speak only to what you've heard. Do that, and you can't go wrong. Improv is not just a means to entertain, it's also a process that is an end in itself, a way of knowing, of grasping the nature of another, the reality of the other's existence, an aspect of the truth of the matter under discussion, which you thought you knew, but didn't until this moment. Which is also why a successful improv is exhilarating, uplifting, enlightening, renewing. That first night, after we wrapped, I did feel rather exhilarated and uplifted, if not yet enlightened and renewed. There'd been only two short scenes, and my role was pretty secondary, but something remarkable had happened both times, and that simple advice had done it. Listen. As I pondered this, a memory was suddenly standing in the far shadows of my mind. Hadn't Father Joe, 20 or more years ago, said an almost identical thing? The only way to know God, the only way to know the other, is to listen. Listening is reaching out into that unknown other self, surmounting your walls and theirs. Listening is the beginning of understanding, the first exercise of love.
None of us listen enough, do we, dear? We only listen to a fraction of what people say. It's a wonderfully useful thing to do. You almost always hear something you didn't expect.
We must listen because we are so often wrong in our certainties. When we pass a motion in the chaotic debating chamber of our heads, it's never completely right, or even most of the time, half right. The only way to edge closer to the truth is to listen with complete openness, bringing to the process no preconceptions, nothing prepared. No question that there were startling parallels between what the fathers of improv and Father Joe had to say, between Second City and the City of God. How seldom, in fact, did I listen? I brought to almost every encounter with another human some preconception of people or issues, none too subtly intent on getting mine out before the other guy. New York was a city of non-listeners. Long years now, since something Father Joe had said had fit so immediately and precisely into my life. Perhaps I was ignoring a great resource, a resource to whom I'd once turned at every opportunity, but to whom I had, quite simply, stopped listening. The next day of shooting was the same. And the next. The understanding didn't falter, the listening and the flow continued, the work began to have bulk and shape. More and more, as it proceeded, the movie rekindled my faith in the precious stuff of laughter, in the miraculous manner in which it was generated, and the unpromising landscapes from which it could be mined, so long as you were willing to listen. My urgent need to off myself became less urgent, was postponed, and in the weeks that followed, quite forgotten. So I suppose I can say, in a way that others who've claimed the same perhaps can't, that rock and roll saved my life. At least, rock and roll as played by Spinal Tap. Chapter 14.
It sounds to me, dear, as if your satirist is a bit like a monk. They both take a rather dim view of the world, and both try to do something about it.
Thank you, Father Joe. I think I knew that once, but I'd forgotten. Contemptus mundi. We both have contempt for the world.
You persist in your error, my son. Contemptus does not mean contempt. It means detachment. Are you detached from the things you satirize?
I am now. I'm unemployed. It was 2 weeks before Easter 1984, a year of some significance to the satirist. We were back under the mighty Benedictine oaks of Core, where we'd walked when I was young and he was not yet old. The grey-green leaf clusters were beginning to sprinkle the massive limbs and trunks of the trees, beneath whose rugged skin I still fancied I could see huge muscles slowly flexing. The oaks formed gnarled, unstately arches, through which the sullen Solent heaved. Grey, blue-grey, charcoal-grey, the colours of school uniforms. The face was much the same, long and raw, deeply creased but still unwrinkled. Father Joe never seemed to change physically or in any other way. When I first met him, I couldn't peg his age, and if this had been my first visit, I still wouldn't have been able to. 50? 80? He was 75. He walked with a slight stiffness, his sandaled feet still as flat and turned out as a character in Asterix comics. When I'd arrived, I told him this. He chortled. "I love Asterix. Can't get enough of Asterix. You read comics at core now?" "Good heavens! These days we have a hi-fi, with headphones." That drew me to his ears, which had grown as old men's do. Or do old men shrink everywhere but their ears? Anyway, they were Dumbo-sized jobs by now, with lobes like mud flaps. It was almost 4 years since I'd seen him, the longest Joe-less period ever. In the second half of the 70s, I'd started to visit Cor more regularly again, once a year or so. For some reason, the discomfort of the early Lampoon years had passed. There was an element of filial duty to these visits, but as New York, off life support, plunged into bicoastal wildness, and my post-Lampoon freelancing took off, these two things usually blending in the bathroom of Elaine's and involving $100 bills, Father Joe also became my counterintuitive little secret, something no one else could boast. Others had to buy their self-improvement in a book. I had, in the flesh, my very own Maharishi, Lao Tzu, Mr. Natural. We'd take a pleasant walk, having very much the same conversation every time. It proceeded on parallel paths, rather than really connecting. I would enumerate and explain my various projects, this book or that TV special, a movie I was writing in Paris, plans for a new humor magazine. I never knew how much he understood or absorbed of all this, but I suspected it didn't matter. I figured he was content to hear the distant muzak of my activity. On his side, though he knew how hostile or apathetic I was about the church by now, he'd chatter on about his old friend God, quite unself-consciously, not at all in that defensive, half-missionary tone the pious adopt when speaking to the impious. I didn't find it grating, as I once had, but nor did I absorb all of what he was saying. It was just soothing and cleansing to be around him. I might be of the world, but there's nothing to beat a hefty hit of monastic peace. We had reached a certain stasis, neither advancing nor regressing, saint and cynic side by side. On this visit, though, it wasn't stasis or comfy chats I was looking for. I needed something that I could get nowhere else, least of all in New York. A confessor. A shrink who knew right from wrong. One who would talk while I listened. I had a lot to get off my chest. I wanted advice. I wanted comfort. I wanted guidance. I wasn't quite sure what. I planned to stay as long as necessary. The proximate cause of the visit was my latest enterprise, a British comedy series called Spitting Image. It's a pretty good rule of thumb in showbiz, as in marriage and foreign policy, that you keep making the same mistakes again and again. Trouble is, you never realize it's the same mistake until you've well and truly made it. While still at the Lampoon, I'd come across a pair of brilliant British caricaturists named Roger Law and Peter Fluck. They called themselves Luck and Flaw, to further confuse employers already confused by the treacherous name Fluck. Their trademark was sculpting from plasticine, a British kiddie product rather like silly putty, brutally funny life-sized caricatures of the great and famous, which they then costumed, propped, placed in outrageous environments, and photographed. I had hired them to do some work for the Lampoon, and we became fast friends. They were both huge guys, especially Law, who looked like a Cornish pirate, topping 6'5" and 20 stone, or 280 pounds, a red bandana permanently enclosing his balding monastic pate. They were working-class lads who had grown up in the Fens around Cambridge, met while attending art school there, and made extra money serving tables in, of all places, St. John's College. At some point, they had probably served me my dinner or cleared it away. Though I was just as much a prole as he, Rog would frequently refer to me, with much tugging of non-existent forelock, as the young master. After I left the Lampoon, we began talking about making their caricatures into life-sized puppets that could move and talk and perhaps star in a TV series. The Muppets were all the rage on both sides of the Atlantic, so this was not that far-fetched. Thanks to Jim Henson, the technology existed to make large puppets talk and move on camera. I began paying regular visits back to the UK to help develop the project, which by the early 80s, with the infusion of some capital from pioneer tech entrepreneur Sir Clive Sinclair and the recruitment of a hot young TV comedy producer named John Lloyd, was looking feasible. I'd first met Lloyd when he was producing the hit BBC Two series Not the 9 o'clock News. He broke the ice by confessing that he'd stolen the word not from me, the first known use of this hoary parody prefix having been Not the New York Times. Lloyd was also an alumnus of Cambridge Footlights, so we had that link as well. He was 13 years younger than I, and Rog and Pete. He already had a British Academy Award. He was the golden boy of British TV comedy, and he was fascinated by the puppets. He looked like the right man to get our show off the ground.
Tony, dear, you've never told me much about satire. How does it work?
Good question. First of all, it's cruel and unfair. It hurts people, and it's supposed to. You take on the colouring of your target's thoughts and beliefs and exaggerate them mercilessly. But you can't do it just arbitrarily without knowing them. You have to be inside his skin. Or in the case of Maggie Thatcher, her hide.
Good heavens, it sounds horrible.
It's not a pretty business. He walked thoughtfully for a dozen paces, much twitching of lips and eyebrows, setting lobes aflutter.
Tony, dear, by inside Mrs. Thatcher's hide, do you mean you're thinking the way she does?
Part of you is, yes.
And that would be the unpleasant or unkind side of her, the side you want to criticize with your satire?
Absolutely.
So that would mean you have an unpleasant or unkind side too?
Well, no, not necessarily. How had we got here so fast? I was supposed to be the expert. It's a question of mimesis, I explained. You're just mimicking her cruelty or hypocrisy or whatever. It's like a kid walking behind an old man, copying his limp.
You don't mean the satire is childish, of course?
Nope. It's serious grown-up business. I think of it as a branch of journalism, the inspired lie that's closer to the truth than any number of carefully researched facts.
I'm sorry, dear. Did you say satire was a lie?
Only in the sense that all art is fabrication. He walked for some distance, head down, concern in his busy brows, thinking this over. The silence between us grew so long that I was on the brink of saying something when he stopped.
You don't think, dear, that if you do a great deal of mimicking cruel or hypocritical people, it won't have a bad effect on you eventually?
Satirists do have a way of turning into what they satirize. But it's a risk I'm willing to take, if you can bring the bastards down.
Does satire often bring the bastards down?
Alas, no. The year before, back in the United States, there'd been more ominous signs of a sea change. Newsweek, for the first time, put parody on its cover, in the shape of Sean Kelly, an actor named Alfred Gingold, who'd written a best-selling parody of the L.L. Bean catalogue, and me. Being on the cover was dandy, but the cover story was rather negative, suggesting that parody was something of a cultural parasite, a view I didn't entirely disagree with if its targets were trivial, and the parody was of style, not substance. Sean and I made that point by immediately publishing a parody at Ballantine called Not the Bible, which included texts previously unknown to biblical scholars, such as Christ, the early years. In fact, it was less a parody than a frontal satirical assault on Christ-free Pharisees like Messrs. Falwell, Baker, and Robertson. Nonetheless, it was the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston who stood up for Jesus. His Eminence gave Not the Bible a loud non imprimatur and asked that it be taken off sale. Rather than nail the prissy prince of the church to the First Amendment, Ballantine stopped shipping the book. The scrofulous boneheads from the Knights of Columbus and the Catholic League of Decency, whom Sean and I had held at bay 10 years earlier, were now calling the shots. Things had to be better in the UK, given its tradition of irreverence and experimentation. That was the week that was, and Monty Python, to name but two. Plus, they had a genuine left-wing opposition, not like our mildewed and compromised Democrats. Here, some truth could be told to power, some real pain inflicted on the high and mighty. In reality, the Labour Party was being led by the doddering Michael Foote, who made Fritz Mondale look like Rambo. And Ronnie's girl Maggie, with the Miners and the Malvinas under her belt, was at the zenith of her power. Rog and Pete and I were also ignorant of a subtler problem, one to which the antennae of the politically adroit and super-ambitious Lloyd were acutely tuned. There had been a long history of tension between politicians and broadcast authorities, especially the BBC, over the airing of political satire on British TV. It went all the way back to TW3 two decades earlier. There was plenty of experience on both sides of how to deal with political satire. Lloyd had already navigated these shoals with Not the 9 o'clock News. We made an excellent deal at Central TV, the arm of ITV in Birmingham, with ample creative legroom, mainly because Central's director, Charles Denton, was politically in our camp. But for those very reasons, we were all going to be watched like hawks by the far more conservative ITV board. You seem very worried about the effect satire has on the satirist, Father Joe.
Well, this business of mimicking evil. But I suppose you're not committing it in any way. I think St. Augustine applies here. In his Confessions, he admits to sin, to a knowledge of sin, even a longing for it. We all have evil in us. To admit it is essential. Perhaps your satire is a way to admit the evil in you without giving into it.
Well, that's comforting. Still, I'm more interested in the effect on my targets of changing people's perception of those in power.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, for Beyond the Fringe, the Tories, the Church of England, the romanticizers of World War II. For Voltaire, the Jesuits. The U.S. military for Stanley Kubrick.
So the point of satire is to change the way people think about the Tories or the Jesuits or American military men?
There usually is a certain us-them attitude. Satire is one weapon the powerless have against the powerful, or the poor against the rich, or the young against the old.
Satire always divides people up into two groups.
I suppose that's often its dynamic, yes.
Is that a good thing?
It's the way the world works, Father Joe. People think in teams. We're good, you're evil. We're smart, you're dumb. We're upper crust, you're vulgar. I think most humor works that way. Even the most basic jokes. The English tell Irish jokes. In America, the most notorious jokes are Polish jokes, because the Poles have been stereotyped as stupid.
Tell me a Polish joke.
Okay. What has an IQ of 212?
I don't know, dear.
Warsaw. Father Joe gazed at me expectantly.
Is there a joke coming?
That's it. The entire city of Warsaw has a combined IQ of 212.
Oh. But the Poles are rather sensitive people, aren't they? Tragic and poetic and long-suffering. Look at Chopin, or even the Holy Father.
Okay, Chopin and Jean-Paul II are not Polish jokes. But the dynamic holds for jokes about Tories, or blondes, or the French. Father Joe's eyes brightened.
Tell me a joke about blondes.
You display immodest eagerness, Father.
I like blondes.
I told him a fairly clean blonde joke. He didn't get it. I explained about dumb blondes. He still looked puzzled.
To say people are stupid when they're not, isn't that a little cruel?
I think it's basically harmless, really. A safety valve, letting off ethnic or sexual tensions.
I see what you mean.
We walked quite away in silence. He was frowning now, pursed lips pouting and unpouting with the regularity of a diaphragm.
You see, dear, I think there are two types of people in the world. Those who divide the world up into two kinds of people, and those who don't.
One thing I'd told nobody was that I badly wanted to come home to England. Come home at the top of my game, with an original and controversial hit, bringing together everything I'd learned in the US and all the wit and flair and innovation of British TV. British TV, after all, was the best in the world. British TV guys told us so all the time. Even if it failed, I wouldn't mind, so long as we went down in a blaze of glory. That ought to get me started in my new base, the place I belonged, where I really spoke the language, which didn't feel like a foreign land the way the US was beginning to. Dear old England, land of the creatively free, home of the artistically brave. And yet, in truth, I had little deep feeling for England. I'd always felt like an outsider growing up, which was probably why I'd split at the first opportunity. I was aware, too, that I was no longer, in a cultural sense, very English. An entire generation which was being born as I was leaving had grown to adulthood. They had innumerable points of reference, memories of things great and small, I couldn't tap into at the reflex level you have to if you want to make people laugh. The country looked different from the place I'd been young in, whether it was the hideous new motorways carving up the lovely countryside, or the Cockney accent emerging from an exquisite Asian face. Complaining about the one, being delighted by the other, meant nothing to the English. These things were deeply woven by now into the fabric of normality, beyond unremarkable. That I noticed them only remarked me, as an outsider. Just as the teenage monk had, I was going in exactly the opposite direction from my contemporaries. The crowd